My dad left when I was 5. Moved to drink and skirt. And me and my mum moved into my grandparents in a tower block, a stiff walk to the city centre, or a number 12 yellow double-decker down the fiveways. I don't remember my dad. He tried to take me away, so my mum cut him out. I remember the crosses Grandad had made in the paint on the fourth floor, so I knew I had walked up the right number. I was too titchy to reach at the lift. I remember being taken into a corrugated kid's den on the waste ground behind the shops, and having my trousers pulled down by some big girls and not understanding what they were doing and sobbing. But I remember Saturdays best of all. Down to the city in the morning, me and Granddad buying cheap cuts off the rag market and a big bag of scratchings for munching on later in front of the TV. Then me messing and Granddad tinkering in his den, a scary place underneath the flyover. A wondrous place where I could twist old radios, stick noses into pots of evil-smelling liquids, prod boxes of knick-knacks and wire, and melt odd bobs of metal nicked from the foundry. Hi there, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Guild Podcast, the podcast of the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. I am your host, Chris Mary Holtzman, and we are once again talking to an author from Breaking Rules Publishing. It is kind of fun how these people kind of, I got Chella Corrington got a tip from Jennifer Gordon to contact me, and today's guest, Nick C. Gerard, got a tip to contact me through Chella Corrington, and they all belong to Breaking Rules Publishing, so it's kind of fun. Not much to go about now. Some exciting news coming up shortly, I hope, that I will be able to announce, but I will keep you in the dark on that for now. But let's go right into the interview with Nick Gerard. So, welcome Nick Gerard to the Guild Podcast and my little nook here. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously a little bit frustrating having a little bit of tech issues here, but I think as tech becomes more and more advanced, more and more issues appear.
Arise.
Yeah. So... that's good. How are things over on your end? Because you're in the Czech Republic, right? How are things over there?
Things are good. Yeah, the lockdown is kind of over now.
Yeah.
We locked down really early, and as well, you're in Sweden, aren't you?
Yeah.
You didn't lock down at all.
Oh, but... no, and we're seeing the problems arise now.
Well, we. The old Stalinists really know how to lock down a country. And so from the right at the beginning of March, we locked down and we had to wear masks and social distancing, and nobody went to work. All the schools were closed, and now everything is open. All the kids they've been back at school a month. Now they've finished school. School's over, and all the kids have gone away this week to camps. Scout camps, football camps, sports camps. So they're all. So all the adults are really happy because all the bars are open, all the beer gardens are open, and all the kids are in the camps. So life is kind of back to normal here. We even the masks, which were still compulsory on trams and in shops stopped on Friday, and we don't have to wear masks in shops and things like that.
Well, that's good.
But I still do, actually. I still, in the shops and on public transport, I still wear the mask. But basically, yeah, they got it down. They locked it down and they got rid of it. We have very, very, very few cases. I don't know of any now at all. So it's kind of, we're back to normal. Yeah. Sun's shining and the pub gardens are open.
That's nice. I guess people should maybe take, and I think it's weird because we haven't heard anything from that part of Europe, the more eastern part of Europe. There's been no discussion about how the virus has affected any of the old countries, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, in any of those places. So,
yeah, I think what they did, the old communist countries, my sister lives in Serbia, and they were even more strict there. I mean, they had curfews from like 4 o'clock Friday afternoon to Monday morning. They were not even allowed on the streets.
Oh, okay.
So, the old Stalinists, like you say, they locked it down. And actually, they did a good job. They did a really good job. We had, there was a big call out to make masks, and all the Czech women got their sewing machines out, and they made 10 million masks in 3 days. So everybody had masks. It was great. Really, kind of community got together. The government actually got something together. Everyone hates the government, but actually they really did a good job in this case.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I said, it's interesting to hear. I mean, that sounds like it's a real success story, and I think maybe people could learn a thing or two from that. But
well, I think I'm from the UK. I'm from Birmingham, so, and they could definitely learn a few things in the UK about what's happening here.
Yeah.
Because in the UK, it's a complete disaster. I think that I'm not even allowed to go in to visit. If I go in, I have to quarantine for 2 weeks before I can visit my mom.
Yeah.
And it's just mad. And so what the rest of Europe are doing is, like, British citizens are not allowed into Czech Republic. They're just not letting any British people in because of the... And Sweden is on the red list as well.
Absolutely, I know, yeah. And the thing is, I'm American too, so I, like, come from, like, two places that are...
You ain't going anywhere, Fred.
I'm not going anywhere. No, that's true. So actually, it's an interesting point. So why is a Brit in the Czech Republic?
No,
how did you end up there?
I came here in 1995 because I was at a loss of something to do. I'd been living in Lisbon, drinking far too much, and
as you do,
I needed to get out after 2 years. I had a great time, and my sister was living here, so she got me a job here, and I met my wife here, and then we left and went back to England, and then we went, did some traveling. I'm a big traveler. I've lived in about 6 countries, and after living in Cambridge and then Spain, Portugal, then we ran an eco-tourist lodge in Malawi, on Lake Malawi, and then we decided to come back to Europe, and we set up an eco-tourist lodge in the mountains in Czech, and we did that for about 7 years, and it was really great. We had people from all around the world come and visit us, and it was kind of, if you can't do traveling for a living, you know, it's difficult. The next best thing is to get people to travelers to come visit you. And we had great characters, because we were green and eco-friendly, and we were an eco-farm and stuff. We had very interesting guests. All our guests were great. We had like this Alaskan fisherman who'd spent 2 years in the wilderness of Alaska as a gamekeeper kind of thing.
Like a trapper?
Yeah, something like that. He was just like a big grizzly bear of a man. And his wife had worked with street kids in Brazil, so we had all these really great people. And but in 2008, we after the economic crash, we were 50% down, so we sold up and moved to Olomouc, is where we're at now, which is about the fourth biggest city in Czech Republic. It's a great little place. It's like a mini Prague with no tourists. It's like the old center of Prague, so people get an idea. It's the old center of Prague, concise in a small area. And we live right in the center of that. So it's great level of historical building, cafes, theaters, and no tourists. So it's great. So it's a great place to bring up a kid. So that's why I'm here.
So I'm guessing like running, traveling a lot and running eco lodges and stuff like that, and as you said, meeting a lot of different characters, must have inspired you in creating characters when you write.
My first book was published, so I've had four books published. The first one was called Traveling for the Hell of It.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, along the way of doing, I'd done some kind of travel journalism and some stuff for guidebooks while I was traveling. And I did some essays and things like that. And I kind of put it all together with short stories thrown in. And that's what it's called, A Kind of Travel. So it's kind of like it's mishmash of stuff to do with getting drunk in Paris and then ecotourism in Malawi. What I think of NGOs, and some short stories thrown in there. So yeah, I think the traveling definitely helped me a lot. And still, even now, I'm putting together a new collection of short stories to be out hopefully this year. That is set in Brazil, Argentina, set in Malawi. So I use all these places and characters from my travels in my short stories. I'm mainly a short story writer.
Mm.
That's where I come from. So I had the travel book, and then after I did, I was in the mountains, so I had plenty of time to write. So I thought I'd, because I was a punk back in the 70s.
Yeah.
I started writing then when I started writing punk lyrics and influenced by Joe Strummer, The Clash, The Jam, people like that. And that's where I started writing. And I kind of put together a poetry book called Lyrics Without Music. So, and then I put a short story collection together of called Graffiti Stories, which was kind of... I like kind of social realism style, gritty realism, as some people call it, or Brit grit, as somebody is saying, like stuff. So, all about kind of underdog protagonists, so like an alcoholic gay guy in Lisbon, a trade union guy in Birmingham, all characters I know from the working class background and from the areas I grew up in, the areas that I've lived in. So, and then we come on to my book, which is out now, Punk Novelette, which is why I'm here.
Yeah. So, I mean, does it, because, I mean, obviously your stories or your novels fall under kind of the category which I think most people would call that just literary fiction, no specific genre?
I think, yeah, literary fiction, social realism, you could kind of say, kind of dirty, there's various gritty realism, dirty realism, social realism. I like kitchen sink realism. I like that as well.
It's very, very common in Sweden, that term.
So, you know, I kind of was influenced by people like Alan Sillitoe, who wrote The Long List, The Long Distance Runner, and Barry Hines, who wrote Kez. So these people were the only people we kind of, I read when I was a kid, because they were writing about working class people's lives. I didn't go to university because I left school kind of 15 and a half, and so we didn't have any chance to go to university or anything. So the book... punk being around there kind of influenced us for music and art, and we got into politics and things like that. So I was then kind of started to read things that a lot of the old hippies that I met kind of. So I read the Beats, you know, Kerouac and and these people, and I read Emmett Grogan, a book called Ringo Ligio, which I really loved. It was all about his life in New York, and then he was in the IRA, then he set up the hippies. And then Brendan Behan, Borstal Boy, all about working class kid who was in prison and stuff. So, and Bukowski, I like Bukowski and stuff like that. Also Steinbeck, I do love Steinbeck's short stories and novellas and things like that. So I was kind of influenced by those people and Orwell as well, his essays. I liked Orwell's essays more, and the stories about his life I liked. So, yeah, social realism and writing about working class, you could say working class literature as much, because there's not a great outlet for working class people who didn't go to the right schools in the UK. No. And have the right connections to get published and get stuff back. That's a great thing about the internet. It's made it kind of more open for writers to get out there, get their stuff out there.
I was going to say absolutely. I was discussing that with my wife the other day that. You know, the internet allows for a lot more opportunity to get published, but there's also, with that, there's a higher degree of competitiveness. I mean, still, there are only so and so many spaces. There's only so and so many publishers, and I think you can self-publish, and that's fine, but. I don't think being part of maybe like a publishing house or a publishing family just makes things a little bit simpler, easier. I think that's what people in the end want. Yeah,
I had kind of, my first book was published by Jotify, and they were rubbish. So I terminated the contract with them and self-published it. And that went quite well. And the poetry book I self-published again. And then Travelling for the Hell of It was picked up by a small independent publisher in England called Scooby Books. And they put it out. And they did okay. It was quite good. And then I was kind of picked up by Breaking Rules Publishing. I don't know if you know any of those authors from there.
Lately, I've been interviewing quite a few from Breaking Rules.
Yeah. We're doing the rants.
Yeah.
That's what you said about competitiveness, but actually, like, we have a really good community on Breaking Rules Publishing, where we're flogging each other's books to hell all over social media, interviews, and we have daily author where everybody promotes one author. So that's really great. So Breaking Rules published Graffiti Stories, and then they published book novelette recently. And hopefully they're going to publish my next short stories collection soon.
So, yeah, did you have to go through
it? I'm also the chief editor of a literary magazine called Jotters United.
Okay.
We were a collection of writers. We were on Jotify, which was a site, and then a publisher, and it was a community of writers. We shared work, and the guy who ran it was just doing it for the money, and it was a real pity because it was a good community. So when he closed it down, I set up a Facebook group, and then we decided to set up a magazine. So we've done about 26 different issues. Jotters United, it's called. And so that's great. We were able to do keep the community going and set up our own magazine. Really easy to do, you know. Like, only online when selling paper magazines.
I think there are quite a few literary magazines, but I think very few of them publish anything real, any physical copies. Because probably the publishing books is fairly easy. I mean, you have the outlets, you have Amazon.com, you have at Barnes & Noble, and you have Smashwords and all that stuff. But I think maybe literary magazines might be a little bit more difficult to put out there, find distributors.
There's not many that do. Breaking Rules do publish monthly magazines.
Yeah.
They do three different literary magazines, one horror, one lesbian and gay literature, and one scribe, which is just literary fiction.
Mm.
And they produce hard copies, which you get on Amazon, and they do that monthly. But they're kind of the only ones I know, really, who buys magazines? Where do you go to buy a literary magazine? I think that most of the magazines which I get published on now are online. People like Spillwords, Literati, these are kind of one of the best ones that are out there. They don't produce hard copies.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just too difficult, the logistics of it, too.
Yeah, I think so, too. But I would like to kind of go back to the whole literary fiction, social realism, because the people that I interview usually tend to lean towards some kind of genre fiction writing, horror, fantasy, science fiction, whatever. And those things often have, there's a common thread to them. You know, horror has to be based on, you know, fears, or, you know, that's the center of it, the epicenter, and then you build a story around that. And I think probably the listeners, those who listen to this podcast, who are interested in the craft of writing, and I'm very interested in that as well. I've only written a few literary or social commentary pieces that have been not genre specific, but how do you make up, what becomes the theme of a short story that you're going to write that doesn't have science fiction or horror or fantasy? You know, there's no quest in it. There's nothing that goes bump in the night. What does the narrative look like for you when you decide to sit down and write a story? What is it that you decide you need to write it about?
I think a lot of times it's the characters that I've met during my life.
Yeah,
I've had quite an interesting life. So like Graffiti Stories is kind of all of the underdog protagonists, if you like.
Mm.
So, and the alcoholics and those kind of people. And I kind of get inspired by everyday stories of extraordinary stories of everyday people, if you like.
Mm.
There's a story called Freaks about an old punk guy I knew who used to live in a tree. and so that's good. And there was a trade union guy who I met who was so passionate about his trade unionism, you know, that he really inspired me. And then the book I'm writing now is called Struggle and Strive, and it's a collection of short stories. And I thought, well, Graffiti Stories, I'd written it kind of like, you know, it was drug addicts and it was alcoholics, and it was fairly, I suppose, negative in a negative way. But I thought there were stories that were worth getting at, because they're about real people's lives. And the new book is more about people still struggling with their lives. So I'm very politically motivated. I was involved in politics a lot. And what I wanted to do was write a book where actually the working class win for a change. So I've written stories about Argentinian workers who take over their factory, the rubber tappers in Brazil, what else? Casual workers in England, you know, on no contracts,
no
chance of getting a contract and things like that. But like he's striving for something more positive in his life. So I think this was all political. I set out to write a political short story book of based on working class people or normal people's lives, and inspired by stories as well. But there's a story in there called The Powder Puff's Journey, which is a story of my wife's aunt who survived the Holocaust, survived the camps, and she survived it with the powder puff. A woman's powder puff little case, and that was kind of what do you call it? Auto fiction. So it's kind of autobiographical, but I kind of I couldn't get the whole story from her, so I had to invent bits around. So, yeah.
Yeah. So when did writing come easy to you? I mean, you said you left school quite early and you didn't attend uni or anything like that, but and I'm thinking growing up in the climate of this of the punk era, it was all DIY, do it yourself. I mean, it didn't really matter, autodidactic kind of thing. But did writing, was it a struggle for you to get into writing?
Not really. I was working in a horrible factory, an assembly line factory, and then sitting at the end of the, hiding away in the corner, writing lyrics for my punk band. So it did kind of come quite easily. I wasn't kind of inspired at school. We weren't inspired at all by our teachers. So then from writing punk lyrics, you're right about the DIY thing. We put our own gigs on. We did our own fanzines. I then started writing kind of reviews for punk, and then started writing punk political pieces. So if we did a gig like for to raise money for an unemployed center, because there was a lot of high unemployment in the late 70s. Mm. And I'd write out a political piece about it that we would hand out at the gig. So I never had any trouble writing. And I got into sort of story writing through the travel writing, really, because when I started, it was really difficult to get into to try and write the travel books again. But then there were some travel magazines came out in the kind of 90s, and then they wanted kind of a stories journalism, your stories of living in. So I would say that the story of me living in Malawi was not journalism, was more like a short story. And from that, I thought, well, this is quite good, and I'm quite good at it.
Yeah.
So I should do something. So I went back into the UK, and there's the Workers' Education Association. It's set up by the trade unions, and they do short courses for working class people. And I went to a night class, a writing class, and it was great. And we had a professional writer there. Once a week we went there, and I was inspired very much by her. And she got me writing more and more short stories. Mm. And but I don't have trouble to write. I just have trouble to find time.
No, I think, I don't, I personally don't suffer from writer's block. I can sometimes, and I think I'm in a period like that right now, where I'm kind of suffering a little bit more from what I would describe as writer's fatigue. I do have some things that I want to write. When I sit down, I'm struggling to find the energy to do it. It's not that I don't have any ideas. It's just that I can do it, but I'm just finding it. I find that I have other things that are maybe a little bit more pressing.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the editing phase now. With my book being out, I'm in the marketing phase of doing that. So
yeah.
That takes up a lot of time. And I've just finished rewriting and editing the new book, and that's going to go to the editors again. And then I'll come back and I'll do rewrites. So I'm kind of like taking a break, really. I'm just waiting for something to come into my head and some ideas for some new stories or some new book or whatever. I write for a living as well. I mean, I when I don't get paid for my own books, which is very often, I work for a Czech publisher, and I do abridged versions of classic books. So I do Steinbeck, Orwell, Hemingway, all these people. So that's what I do on a daily basis. So I'm writing every day.
Yeah.
Well, not writing, I'm editing, basically. I'm editing their work down to abridged versions, which is kind of fantastic that I'm editing Orwell and Hemingway. Yeah.
But how do you decide what goes in and what gets taken out?
Oh God, it's a question everyone asks me. I don't know. You just kind of you kind of have to slice it down and kind of think, okay, you can do without that sentence. You didn't need to put that in. I have to do quite a lot of books which I don't like the Virginia Woolf, Mrs. Dalloway. I just don't, which I really hated. that was really difficult to do. And Ian Foster, A Room with a View, that was awful to do as well. And at the moment, I'm doing Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot's short stories, which are not bloody short. And it goes on and on and on. So I'm finding that really difficult to edit down. But yeah, just got basically, I turn the computer on every day, every morning, and do 20 pages every day. And finally, I'll get down to the word count, which is acceptable. You know, and I'm almost finished quite up now. So you just keep looking at it and saying, okay, I can get rid of that sentence and that sentence, and that can go out. I rewrite stuff, you know, so take a whole paragraph and say, oh, well, I can rewrite that in a really simple way, really. So I'm kind of thinking of this as my university, really, because I'm getting paid to study all these very famous writers, whether I like them or not.
Yeah. I think you learn and you learn something from all writers, no matter if you care for them or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a big, and a lot of people that come on this podcast love Stephen King, and I'm not a huge Stephen King fan. I find it dull and trite at sometimes. But
yeah, I don't like horror, so I read that kind of stuff, and I haven't had to edit the Stephen King one yet. That'll be quite interesting to do, actually.
But I mean, I learn a lot from Stephen King by reading him and his way of constructing a story, and I think mostly constructing backstories, because I think he's great at constructing a backstory for his characters to make them to make them damaged, kind of, and I like that. I like damaged characters.
Yeah, damaged characters alone.
So I mean, are you doing this in English? Are these English abridged versions?
Yeah, in English. Yeah. It's not translated. It's into English. If you Google me, one of the Googles is that I'm the author of 1984.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird. You get Nick Gerard, 1984, and Great Expectations. It comes up that I'm the author of these books. It's kind of weird.
Well, I mean, I think that's a feather in the cap for anybody saying that they wrote the co-authored 1984 or Room with a View, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So tell me a little
but
bit.
It's a nice way to earn a living. You know, I'm working from home all the time, and I do it in my own time. There's no rush. I don't have really time limits. They give me a whole load of books to do for a year, and it's the easiest job I've ever had, really. So I'm writing every day. I'm not writing my own stuff. And I never sit down at a computer and say, okay, I've got to write something. If I get inspired, like recently I had... two stories published recently. I wrote one about the quarantine, so I was inspired by that, and it got published. I just wrote it the same day, sent it to some magazine, got published. And then there was the Breaking Rules just did a wedding anthology book of wedding stories. So I just wrote the story of me and my wife's wedding day and where I proposed. She was deported. And I proposed at Heathrow Detention Centre, and we got very drunk on the day because we didn't really want to get married, but we had to for the immigration and stuff like that. So I just wrote that, and in amongst all these nice wedding stories is my little story of detention centres and getting drunk and put to bed at 11 o'clock at night because I was comatized in a wedding anthology. So I kind of, you know... even when I don't sit down to write, someone come and say, oh, I can write that, you know, and that'll come up. And sometimes politically, I wrote stuff recently about Black Lives Matter because that's kind of in the news. And I've been asked a lot about it, you know, with the connections with the politics and punk in the 70s and 80s. I seem to be, every time I get interviewed, I'm asked politically. So I wrote some stuff about Black Lives Matter. So I do write essays, political essays, which get published in, magazines online, really, rather than other magazines. There's quite a lot of good political magazines online. The Platform is one that I love.
I think it's difficult, I think, with all that. I mean, because as we were talking about at the top of the show here, we were talking about, like, the competition between authors. There are more resources for authors. It's not easier to get published per se, but there's more places to get published. But I also, I think an issue, a problem with that, and I find it for myself, is that there's so much to read as well. That becomes an issue, because you have to, as a consumer, you have to decide, what do I want to read? And with social media and, you know, Facebooks and Instagram posts and Twitter posts and Reddit and all of those things, that's reading as well. And I think there's also maybe a risk of a reading fatigue, because I can notice.
This is where I think the magazines come in.
Yeah.
Because I think to have anybody, you can go on WhatsApp and put a story on.
Yeah.
Anybody can put a story online now. But having an editor look at your work and reject it, I think, is the important thing here. So that, looking at getting your work published in some of the magazines that are out there is kind of the best way to sort through, the rubbish and the good stuff. Is that stuff that is, editors have actually sat down and looked through their pile, the sludge pile, they call it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I've done the same. I think I've published about 128 different authors, and I've rejected quite a lot as well. And I think that's the magazine kind of scene online, and it kind of helps you find the good stuff. And also then, I think also then when you have a book out, I don't go for this, like, 50, you need 50 reviews on Amazon because the algorithms are good for you. I think it's much better to get reviews from editors from magazines and other writers. Because it's kind of more, I was going to say classy, but that's not the word I was looking for. It's kind of more credible.
Yeah.
If you get a good review, I've got 5 good reviews from quite well-known writers, I'm happier rather than paying some money to some dodgy company who's going to get me 50 reviews from some guy in Manila. So I think that sorts that out. Is the magazine scene quite good, and the kind of the independent press is quite good. You have well-known independent presses that people know are going to produce good work at it. So so I think that sorts that out. From it's a kind of different world from Wattpad. Like Wattpad, anybody can put anything on, and or there are loads of Facebook groups. Passion for books, which is another one. I do advertise it, to look at it, but people advertise any old rubbish and stuff like that. And I kind of think your peers judging your work is kind of a good way of sorting out what's good out there, what's not good out there.
Mm. So if we go back to your punk novelette,
yeah.
Can you just tell us a little bit what it's about?
Okay. I wanted to write it because, there hasn't been any fiction written about those times, the late 70s and the 80s. There was a lot of stuff written after Puck's Punk, if you like.
Yeah.
There was written about that. but there was no kind of fiction written about what it meant to normal people. There's loads of autobiographies and loads of biographies and loads of stuff, you know, about the history of punk. There's loads of documentaries, loads of books, but there's very, very little fiction. So I wanted to write it from the point of view of my experience. But what I did, I kind of, I set that to write a novel, but I kind of turned it into I wanted it to be like a book, a record, if you like, 3.5 minutes of like power, and boom, 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 boom. And my cut down style kind of goes with that, terse, short, and trivial, which is like a novelette was called, they were called terse and trivial, weren't they? And I thought, well, okay, that's what I'll do. I'll write it short. A long, short story, if you like.
Yeah.
So I condensed, I had 12 characters based on people I knew, and I condensed them down into 4 because it kind of made sense to have fewer characters for a novelette. And it's about their lives, really, growing up, being kids of the 60s, all from broken homes, leaving school with no jobs, and the punk coming along and giving them a chance to do something with their lives, which is basically what happened. Me and my friends, that these characters, they all have problems. They have problems with alcoholism, they have problems with heroin, they have problems like anybody else. But actually, they came out the other side, whereas I think without punk, a lot of us, the characters in the book and the people they're based on, we would have ended up in prison or dead or lying in a gutter. And I wanted to paint punk as a positive thing because you get a lot of pictures of, you know, postcards in London, drinking cider on the side of the street, getting people to photograph them. That was not punk for us. Punk was something that came along. There was nothing going on where I lived. I lived in an industrial city, Birmingham, and in Kidderminster. And there was just factories, and half of those were closed down. So just football violence and drinking and violence of an evening, Friday, Saturday night. It was football and violence and girls, and about it. So punk came along and we had stuff to do. Everybody got involved with fashion. Everybody joined a band. Someone said, right, Nick, you're in a band. Go and get a guitar. Learn to play. We're playing next week. And it was great. Then we did our own gigs. We did our own things, and then a movement started, a community started. We would travel around the country, meeting other people, influence. We met a lot of political people, a lot of hippies, a lot of people who were left up in the 60s. So, and then it became very political as well. There was a lot of political strife going on. And that's in the book as well, about the miners' strike in May 4, 1985. Which kind of changed a lot of life. The miners fighting against the state. And basically, yeah, I wanted to show that the punk ethos was a very positive thing. And 4 characters end up, one is a writer, like me. It's not me, but it's like another one is professor in the university, sociology. Another one is activists, the one in the fashion department. So and those are based on friends of mine. That's that they came out the other side and did something with their lives. And so that's why I wanted to do the book, is to tell people about their lives, time, and how punk influences our whole lives. And I still think of myself as punk, and I still think it influences me now. Without it, seeing me being interviewed about writing the book in the Czech Republic with the Giants.
But I think, yeah, probably, because I think the whole punk ideal is to maybe dare to explore something different, to take a chance.
Yeah.
To not be afraid of, to say, like, well, I don't know how to do this.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. I do have this ethos that I can do anything. You know, I've been a teacher. I was a chef in Paris. What else have I done? Ran Ecotourist Lodge. I was a construction worker. I was a trade union organizer. And I do have this kind of thing that, yeah, I could do anything, you know. It's like, just show me how to do it and I'll pick it up. I think the book definitely gave me that kind of that feeling with my life that, you know, that I could do anything, and I've tried to carry on and do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds very interesting. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of Roddy Doyle, with his, you know, like the Commitments and Snapper, and even though his stories are obviously centered through around one thing. A Snapper about a teenage pregnancy or in the Catholic family, and Commitments about people out of work, factory workers.
The van was the other one from that series. All about the one family.
But
I think the book novelette is kind of the opposite of that, because the Irish kind of had their community and very family orientated. Mm. But from where I grew up in the 60s, every one of us was from a broken home.
Mm.
So we didn't. The family is there in a kind of negative way, I think. you know, like I say, we left home at 15 and a half. Most of us did left home at 16, 17. And the punk community became our family rather than families. You know, I never really write anything I write about families. It's usually in a negative way, really. Kind of, apart from my grandfather, who kind of like... influenced me in a good way. In that way, I'm kind of different from Ireland and England, I suppose, because they have a closer family ties there. You know, the Catholicism and the families are very close. In the UK, we kind of lost a lot of that in the 60s. We're all 60s kids. We're all like from divorced families. And then in the 70s, it kind of... And I think also in the UK, the kids leave home a lot earlier. We leave home really early, so we can't break away from the family really quickly. So, I know what you're saying about Roddy Doyle, but you can see that he writes a lot more about the family connection. Like, even in the Commitments, the guy who's running and doing the band is still living at home.
Yeah.
But in the UK, you know, you'd be out of home 16 for sure. You know?
No, I think I was more thinking of like the setting, maybe not the. I mean, this trying to break out of like the working class, you know, stigma, or trying to better yourself.
Yeah, to do something different. Yeah.
But maybe you are closer to Alexander Garland, Alex Garland, and Train Spotting. That whole scene.
I like Trainspotting. I like Irving Welsh and stuff like that. But I did write a lot about alcoholism and drugs and people I knew who got problems. Myself got problems with these stuff. But I kind of and I like Bukowski, but I kind of got bored of writing. You can only write so many stories about being in a drink tank, you know. So I kind of tried to steer. I have written quite a bit like that, but I tried to steer away from it now because, it's kind of got a little bit boring. I think Irving Welsh did it, and he did it well, and you don't need to do that much more. Than read Bukowski. I mean, he wrote everything you can about drinking, you know. And how he ever wrote when he drank, I don't know. I could never write anything when I was drinking, and I don't drink now. I couldn't drink and write like he did.
well, Nick, our time is running short here.
Okay.
Do you have anything special you would like? I mean, apart from your short fiction or your novelette, which is out now and available on Breaking Rules homepage, breakingrules.com, and Amazon, I expect.
Yeah, on Amazon. Yeah.
Do you see any? Do they are your books available in England at all? Is it through Amazon.co.uk or is there any other?
On all the Amazons.
Yeah.
It's on all the Amazons. Yeah. So it's available on those. If you Google my name, you'll find links to short stories. So if people want to have a read for free, short stories, see if they like it before they venture into buying the book. They'll find, if they put Nick Gerard, if you scroll down through Google, you'll find my short stories.
Not only your 1984s and Wuthering Heights.
Yeah. Skip that one, but you'll find me in some of the Spill Words and Piker Press, and a lot of my short stories will be around there and linked on Google. So if people want to have a look through there, or if they go to Nick Gerard the Writer on Facebook, I've got my own page, Nick C. Gerard, but Nick Gerard Writer. Mm. There's loads of links to my short stories there people could read. And see if they like the stuff before they buy the book.
Yeah, we'll put all that stuff up in our show notes. But since the novelette, the punk novelette, I assume that it takes place in Birmingham.
Kidderminster, which is an industrial town near Birmingham, and then Birmingham. Yeah.
Yeah. So have you ever considered trying to, market it in Birmingham?
I've put it in on the pages on Facebook.
Yeah.
For the areas where, the areas where I live. So like Kidderminster, which is where a lot takes place. Put it on those pages and Birmingham pages as well. Just cultural pages, pages for communities. So I put it on there saying, these pubs are mentioned, these characters are mentioned. That's my only way of kind of marketing it as, because it does switch. It goes we then move a lot to London and Manchester. We're in Manchester as well. And then see, go all around the world wherever people are. So, I've tried to market it locally in Birmingham and Kidderminster.
You'll just have to next time when you're allowed to go there, once everything lockdown is done, you can probably sneak in a copy at the local library.
Well, that'd be great to put it in the local library. Yeah, so I think I've got a lot of sales through putting it on there actually, from local people who I know. And that's the great thing about Facebook. Loads of people who I haven't seen for 30 odd years, are on Facebook, and when I put my books, I said, "Look, I've got this book about punk." And they're like, "Well, I've got to read it, it's all about where we lived and about those lives." Even though even though they weren't punks, they knew us as punks.
Yeah.
But it'd be great to do a book reading in Birmingham and Kidderminster at some time. But it's not going to happen in the near future.
Not this year, at least. Not this year. But you'll have to, I'm sure you can get together with like local, like a tourism agency or whatever. I don't know what they, here in Sweden, they have like a certain, like they have like a tourist agency in like in every county. And they like in charge of like what happens at the library, what happens at, here and here and here. They take care of the websites. And I don't know if they have that in Britain or not, but I mean, you can always contact those and say, like, once things open up and say, like, "Hey, I'm Nick Gerard. I wrote this book about Birmingham, Kidderminster. Is there anything we can do?"
That's a great idea. That's great. I'll look into that. Yeah. I was thinking of sending also to local newspapers as well some free ebook copies. Mm. See if anybody wants to review it. That'd be quite good to get reviewed in the local paper.
Yeah, absolutely.
So all in my marketing strategy that I'm into at the moment. Yeah. So that's another thing I've just added to my list. Thanks.
You're welcome. Well, Nick, it's been a delight talking to you, even if we had some tech problems initially. But it's very interesting, and it seems like you've lived an interesting life. And, excited to see what you're going to be putting out next.
Yeah, well, Struggle and Strife is the name of the collection that should come out this year. It's always a difficult thing to know when to put the book out,
really, yeah,
because it's not going to get properly edited till August. And so then I want to do rewrite and then edit it again back to the editors. So that'll be September, October. So then you think, well, if I put it out now, it's almost into the next year. So your next year's book. Mm. You know what I mean? So So you don't know whether to put it out for Christmas so people would buy it for Christmas or wait till January. So it's a book for next year. So it's a new book that's published this year, you know, kind of September, October, it will be ready. So it's a strange time to put a book out, really, because you're kind of like, you know, as soon as you get to January, you're last year's books, you know, and your books haven't been out 2 months. So it's something I'll need to talk to the publishers about, what they think is the best time to put it out, really.
Yeah.
But it should be out. It's either going to be out before Christmas or in the new year. So it's called Struggle and Strive.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, I would like to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having us. It's been great. Great chatting. Sorry about all the technical problems.
It's as it should be, I guess.
Yes.
This day and age. Well, you take care.
And you. Great to meet you.
Yeah. And that was that. Welcome back. That was a great interview. We had a long chat afterwards, also picking the brain of Nick Gerard, who it was very interesting with DIY writers like that. I mean, we're all kind of indie authors are DIY, but, you know, the whole punk scene fascinates me a lot. And that whole world. I'd like to thank Nick Gerard for coming on the show. I'd like to thank all you listeners. I'd like to thank John Holpen for providing music for today's episode and all our episodes. Please share this on your social media. Tweet it out, Facebook it out, Instagram it out, or whatever. Give us a star rating. It helps the algorithm. Gets more listeners in. It's all that I really ask. Also, the rest of you, stay safe out there. Things are crazy still, so stay safe, read a lot of books. I'll talk to you next time.